just say your name and your previous role?
Right, my name's Chris Hinton, age 57. I'm a one-time history teacher, head of history, SHP secondi, part-time PGCE history tutor, history textbook author, and curriculum deputy of a comprehensive school.
Thank you. Please, can you tell me a little about yourself, your home background, parents, schooling? Can you remember anything about the way you were taught history at school?
Yeah, I'm the son of a history teacher and subsequent head, so I hail from a middle-class professional background. I attended two grammar schools in Kent and a sixth form in a private school following my father's career path. I studied modern history at Hertford College, Oxford, and took a PGC at Goldsmiths College, London. The way I was taught history at school was pretty similar throughout my school days in the 1960s. Lessons were largely monologues by the staff, interestingly all male, with the odd interesting story to keep up our interest. The variation came from the more methodical staff who used the blackboard, the more discursive staff who were prepared to debate a few issues, and the mavericks who could be disrupted from the main topics we should have been studying. All written work was notes or essays, which was marked with varying degrees of frequency and thoroughness. But I did like the subject, and I suppose because we didn't know anything different at the way it should have been presented, I was good at it and had the necessary faculties of being a fast writer and a good learner of facts.
So in general, that's what led you to being a history teacher?
Not really. Looking back, I can't see any really strong reason, but a combination of factors which led me to be a history teacher. I think originally I did a fair bit of work with young people. For instance, in the intermediate year between school and university, I was something called a community service volunteer. I was based in a hostel in London for 6 to 9 months, working with young people who'd come to London, lost their way, and needed some support in their future lives. Also, when I was at school, I did work experience at a primary school. But at heart, I think the education world was the one that I was most compatible with. I also enjoyed history and particularly sport, and I was keen to be able to carry on with these. I was also keen to move to London, where of course there were plenty of training opportunities. My politics also are a factor. I'm left of centre, and I was interested in playing a role in the new comprehensivisation which was going on. Looking back, most of the written projects I did at Goldsmiths were around new teaching ideas linked to comprehensivisation, such as mixed ability teaching and integrated humanities. And I also became interested during my course at Goldsmith under my tutors Martin Booth and David Killingray in Bloom's Taxonomy and Bruner's Thinking on Breaking Down Concepts for Young Minds. So that's sort of how I got into teaching and the initial ideas I had to underpin my teaching.
Thank you. So how did you learn to teach history? Was it just at teacher training college, or then did you learn at your first school?
I think if you want to be an effective teacher, you continue to learn how to teach history all through your career. One of the reasons I've recently stopped teaching is that I feel that I'm starting to get out of touch with new ideas, although maybe more due to my management roles than any disinterest in them. My baseline understanding of teaching history came from my PGC at Goldsmiths in 1974-75, as I've said already, under Martin Booth and David Killingray. This underpinned my thinking until I became involved in SHP. My first job was at Crownwood School in Eltham, at the time a huge Ilya flagship comprehensive. I think in relation to my confidence about teaching history, that came pretty quickly. But of course, your focus when you start is really discipline, and that probably took a couple of years before I realised that shouting wasn't effective. In terms of moving on in my understanding of how to teach history, obviously SHP gave me lots of ideas and thoughts. I was particularly influenced by Dennis Shemilt, the SHP evaluator, in his pamphlet The Devil's Locomotive. This introduced me to hierarchies of thinking relating to evidence evaluation. I was subsequently seconded to SHP to produce some materials for East Sussex schools on these lines, and this work subsequently became the textbook What is Evidence, published by John Murray in 1990.
When did you start that work then, looking at Shermult's thinking?
I started it after I'd been head of history at Beacon Community College for about 3 years. The local advisor, a man called Peter Taylor, suddenly alerted me to the fact that the SHP were advertising for teachers secondees to go up to Leeds to work for a term on an idea of their interest relating to SHP. And as he knew that I was an SHP advocate, he encouraged me to apply. In the application, you had to develop an idea and present it to Shemelt and Dawson and such like. And for instance, one of the other colleagues who got it was doing some work on ICT and history teaching, which was very new in those days. My challenge was I'd been interested in evidence evaluation, but felt it was really, really difficult for kids to access some of the concepts behind higher level thinking. And what I wanted to do was to explore ways of presenting work so that students could access higher level thinking. And that was my pitch, and they were interested in that, and that's how I came to get the secondment.
But your initial interest in Shemelt's work?
I got hold of it because of applying.
Oh, right, I see.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known about it otherwise.
Thinking of your earliest days in the classroom, what kind of history did you most enjoy teaching and why?
Could I just return to your previous question about how did you learn to teach history? How long did it take you to feel confident in the classroom? Because I've got a little bit further to go on that one.
Fine.
So after the SHP, there were new initiatives which broadened my thinking on history teaching, such as the A-level, the AB673, I think it was called, which was underpinned by John Fiennes' thinking. This allowed one to do historical methodology at A-level and allowed you to get away from just teaching one thing after another. On the other hand, it also raised the constant issue which comes up in skills work of at times lacking coherence and not allowing the students to familiarise themselves with a specific body of history. And this issue, you know, runs through all history teaching. Other influences have been the, what I call the Christine Council era, where I think her work on things like card sorting to help students think was very helpful. Also working with John Hite of Haywards Heath Sixth Form College on a new approach to sixth form textbooks, where we sought to build in many interesting activities so that the sixth form teacher had many ways of thinking about how to approach the material and the students in a more interesting and accessible way. I was also fortunate to be seconded 2 days a week from my school in the late 80s to the Sussex University PGCE history tutor. The subjects and the thinking, having to teach to students, also motivated me to think about the way teaching should be done, such as looking at things like empathy.
So, going back to the earliest days,
yeah.
What was the history you most enjoyed teaching?
In terms of what kind of history I most enjoyed teaching, I think kind can be interpreted in different ways. If you mean style of teaching, I think there was a sameness about most of my approaches, and therefore a description of different kinds of history can't really come up. In years 7 to 9, my approach was to try and get across some information in the early part of the lesson, hopefully linked to a good story. For example, it might be a description of a battle. I always remember some sea battle called Sluys or Sluys, S-L-U-Y-S, which I used to use. You also look to get the factor into lessons. I remember using a book about the early 20th century American abattoirs called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which had the most wonderful description from a student's point of view of how cows were slaughtered in Chicago abattoirs, and the most definitive description ever of everything that goes into a sausage. Invariably, the rest of any lesson would tend to be writing in its many forms, often linked to a banded worksheet. O-level, CSE, A-level was largely approached through dictated notes with discussion built in at appropriate times. This could be enjoyable, but more in the sense of getting on with the students than feeling that I was pleased with the way I was doing it. I can often remember apologising a lot and using the phrase, "Sorry about this topic, but we have to do it for the exam." The Bessemer converter and how it worked comes to mind as a topic in this category. But kind in terms of eras, I did not really have a priority which I enjoyed more. In the end, everything was determined by how well the students reacted to what I did. I think I find the main medieval, Tudor and 20th century topics work well. I always struggle with 19th century British social, economic and political history. I found that difficult to get the students motivated. That's it.
Yeah. So, how did you first encounter SHP? What attracted you to it, and what difference did it make to your approach?
After a couple of years of teaching at Crownwoods, I was certainly looking for new ways to teach history. I think my head of department and deputy head of history, who like me was interested in new ways of approaching history, alerted me to a 3-day course on SHP in Leeds during one Easter holiday, 1976, 77, something like that. And in those days, I always looked for things to do in the holidays which could save me money, so I decided to go. When I came back, I advocated that we went for SHP, and this is what attracted it to me. First of all, it was a course which had an underpinning rationale for each of the units, which I hadn't seen before. Secondly, we could do new topics each term, or every other term, instead of teaching the same old thing for a whole 2 years. Thirdly, there are interesting new ways of assessing students without just relying on the end of course exam. Fourthly, there was the opportunity that instead of all being history teachers in our own rooms working in an isolated manner, we could build a course as a team and share the resourcing of it. And fifthly, there was a great opportunity for the students to be more active in lessons, with the possibility of getting out of the classroom on things like local visits, and also for a lot of students to see more relevance to their course. So for instance, the modern history unit based around Ireland, the students would at last be getting some sense of why there were IRA bombs going off in London. In terms of changing my approach to teaching history, I think I did less from the front and gave the students more time to be active with their learning materials. Lessons became more varied in approach, moving away from the old talk and write. So this included source work, student presentations, role plays, using modern artifacts and newspapers, and also work linked to doing coursework for the first time.
Did you think it was a pretty revolutionary change to make?
Yes, I did. When I came to my second school as head of history, I always remember standing up before the year nines, of which there was about 400, and talking about this new history course and talking to them about some amazing new invention called coursework, and the amount of choice was remarkable from this new course because it was so different to what was going on in other subjects.
And did you find them enthusiastic then?
Definitely.
At the time when you went back to Crownwoods and suggested SHP, were the other teachers receptive then?
The head of department was a traditionalist, but she was also bright enough to see that there was enough people in the department that were going to go with it, and she supported us, even though I would say that her teaching methods didn't change that much when it came.
So she taught it, but in the old-fashioned way?
She liked being static in a classroom. She liked being magisterial, and that was the way she did teaching.
Yeah, but she still taught SHP, but she did it in a magisterial way.
Yes.
So in a sense, although the course inspired you to do different things, it was something that you felt you wanted to do anyway. It was giving you a license to do more active learning.
Yes.
That's not necessarily making you do it.
I think it would have been very, very hard to teach SHP by dictated notes from the front or notes on the blackboard. So it was almost forced on people.
Do you think it it harder or easier to teach using the SHP method and materials?
I'll interpret the phrase easier to teach as whether the students were more motivated and involved, and whether you were, and whether what you're trying to achieve was clearer. In both cases, I would definitely, certainly say yes, but this is not to say that there are not issues with teaching SHP. I mean, education is much more about children doing rather than listening, and all the research I've seen on this says that they make more progress if they're active. I've answered elsewhere about the benefits in the classroom to using an SHP approach, but certainly the subject has been the top option at GCSE in the two large schools I've taught in. Exams are an interesting issue, and as so often, it comes down to what it is you want to assess and how you feel is the best way to assess it. The old style essays and learning lots of content certainly discriminated against certain children who had a good understanding of history. The SHP approach of adding coursework, doing a skills paper, and having shorter written answers to the main papers allowed more students to show historical ability and to be accredited with it. However, over time, I've wanted to see a few changes in the way the course is examined, some of which are happening, and these are some of the points. The language of many of the exam papers and the concepts used behind the questions can be too complicated at GCSE for papers which are supposed to cover A to G students. They need to simplify some of these questions and concepts, or more likely, as in other subjects, change to a higher and a foundation paper.
There was that was discussed, I think, when GCSE came in, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the other exams, but in the SHP exams, this definitely needs to happen. Secondly, coursework marks are so dominated by the needs of the exam league tables that too much support is now there for the students. I'd like to see a loosening of this support, but with a match use of a controlled coursework assessment in class to ensure consistent standards. This did happen in two of the seven original pieces in SHP coursework, and I believe it is now being brought back into the new GCSEs. Thirdly, I'd like to see one or two more longer questions and a longer exam to allow the students that can do it to be able to be more expansive in their written answers. Finally, I also think the study over time needs looking at and shortened so that you keep the principles of the course but make more sense of the period of history studied. I also think questions in the medicine overview on DNA, science and technology, vaccine in medicine should be replaced by questions which are more accessible in the broader sense to students of history. For instance, a topic like public health, I think, is a much better one to assess and ask questions about DNA and science and technology and everything.
So is public health part of the overview at the moment, but they don't test it always? Is that
they do. And when you test it, you feel that a child can write a proper history essay. When you get a question about DNA or vaccines, you just feel they can't really write a fully rounded, proper response.
Because there's too much technical language required.
Yeah, and it's thin and wishy-washy as well.
Yes.
Whereas public health, you get the social, the political, and there's a substantial overview of the period. You get a sense of period about it. On all these DNAs and vaccinations and science and technology questions, I just feel there's a thinness and a lack of substance to it, and it's very, very hard for the children to access.
Would you have preferred, or would you prefer now with SHP, to have a wider range of development through time topics?
I think they should be shorter. And this idea that you can study crime and medicine over hundreds of years, it just doesn't work at times. I think all the principles of what you're trying to achieve should be done in a shorter period of history. And it may be that the answer has been found, because in the new A-level, which I taught for the first time last year, which was about the influence of war on British history, 1856 to 1929, you could deal with overview and change issues, but you also got a real sense of period and history as well. And I think they should look at that and try and come up with something that more matches that.
Thank you. What do you think should be the balance between learning skills, such as working with evidence, and acquiring knowledge about what happened in the past?
I think the key word here is balance. I believe that when I started teaching history in the mid-70s, it was too knowledge-based. The SHP revolution introduced skills, but to some extent took it too far the other way. However, the arrival of the national curriculum synthesised the two trends, and I'm reasonably comfortable with where the situation lies at the moment. I do, though, feel that another factor has come into play in this age-long debate, and this is the influence of assessment methods, the dubious link between chief examiners and textbook writing, and the all-pervading Ofsted and league table regime. What I mean by this is that the pressure on teachers for results is so great now that an astute teacher will build a certain number of elements into his or her teaching, which influences the history teaching as much as the skills v knowledge debate. Let me give you an example. 2 years ago, my comprehensive had its best ever A-level history results, with 6 A's, 8 B's, 5 C's, and nobody on D, E, or U. Along with good teaching and a positive set of pupils, we'd done the following. Number one, every piece of assessed work from day one was built around exam mark schemes. Therefore, we did no broad-based essay writing as we'd done in the past. Secondly, we brought the revision book written by the chief examiner and based our teaching around every single topic in there. Three, interestingly enough, the course had been extended in time that year, and a new version of the chief examiner's book had come out to serve this change. We noticed that he'd written at length on a certain topic. We prepared it thoroughly, told the students it was coming up, and sure enough it did. So what I'm saying is that the skills v knowledge debate is there, but actually if you play this other game as well, it is almost as big a influence on the way you teach now as those two elements. Now last year the results were good but dropped, and this was caused by one 40 mark question being based around a quote which flummoxed a lot of our students, as it did nationally. And this quote used the phrase in a 20th century topic on despotic tyranny. Now many of us imbued with history might feel the students ought to have known that phrase, as did the Daily Telegraph, but despots, tyrants, to me, come from earlier eras of history. Dictators and totalitarian come from the 20th century, and that is the phrases that they should have used. So what I'm saying overall is that to the skills v knowledge debate must be now added the scientific analysis of assessment systems as a strong influence on the way we teach. And I don't think it's a good influence.
Do you not think that's an issue that's been around for a very long time? Because I can recall under the old A-level system, you used to spend a lot of time question spotting, going back through all the previous papers. And then, of course, when a topic came up on the paper, which was marginal, you then wrote a big letter of complaint or something that couldn't be understood to the exam board.
It influences the way we teach now, because what I'm saying is that we are giving the children narrow-based assessment tasks constantly so that they deliver the so-called scientific response to the mark scheme.
So it's become even more...
I think it's inhibiting what you do. And I also do feel that there shouldn't be this relationship between the chief examiner marking exams and writing the textbooks.
That didn't used to happen in the past,
did it? I don't think so.
Well, let's move on to something more cheerful.
Yeah.
What, in your view, really switches children on to learning history?
Right, okay. First of all, there's this number of crucial elements for any successful teacher, whether a history teacher or not. You've got to have good relationships with the students. You've got to show enthusiasm for your subject. You've got to show interest in the students as individuals. You've got to maintain the discipline. That's a firm but fair learning environment. And you've got to work hard at building ideas which engages the students And finally, you need to make sure that you respond to what they produce. So what makes history that switches on children? I'm going to start at a boring level, really, because I think a good department will have a meaningful scheme of work which has been built together in a cooperative way rather than being left to individual teachers. After that, it's trying to use a great variety of techniques to make the topics interesting, particularly looking for hooks to start a lesson. So for instance, I've actually got a 50 million Deutschmark note from 1923. I've got a Russian army Soviet uniform, and all of these I've used relentlessly for years now to get lessons going in an interesting way. Thirdly, I've got very interested in what I call co-construction, where the students have a bit of a say in how the work is created. A really, really successful example of this has been World War Diaries based on, First World War Diaries written by Year Nines, where they've had quite a lot of leeway in how they go about presenting these diaries. In the past, I've also asked students to interview grandparents about life during the Second World War, and there's been some amazing results which have allowed students to feel proud of themselves and their families. I've also been using a VLE at A level, where the students are able to work together on topics, see each other's work, and do some self-evaluation of essays. And I'll say a bit more about that when we talk about sixth form. Another thing to keep the kids motivated is to make sure they understand what they have to do before they do it. One very important thing I've discovered is that sometimes students do not write very much, not because they can't write, because they don't know what to write. Thus, techniques like the Christine Council card sort, certain scaffolding techniques, make things clearer to the students about what they have to actually write, and therefore they will go away and write it and feel much more confident about themselves.
Can you explain what the card sort does, how it works?
I haven't done a lot of it for a long time, but basically you're doing a topic like, you know, why did William win the Battle of Hastings, and the kids can tell you the story of what happened, but often they can't get to the why. So what you do is you have a series of cards with key ideas on, and you get them to discuss them in pairs and lay them out in certain ways. And in the end, what you tend to get is a certain number of concepts answering the why, and then underneath the concepts are bits of information which you use to support the why.
Right.
So whereas you just say to a child, why did William win the Battle of Hastings? They tell you what happened. If they've done this card sort, and they're more likely to be able to produce the why in the answer.
Okay. Thank you.
And just one other thing, I think children also like it if you can link your teaching to contemporary events which are going on, as a way in.
Do you think that there's any particular content? I mean, you did suggest it was a Bessemer converter.
Yeah.
That some topics are inherently more interesting than others.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, what would you say are the really hot topics? And do they change over time?
Anything with an factor always works. Children like social history a lot.
Do you think they like to learn about other children?
Yeah, definitely. The children in the factories topic, which I'm going to mention another answer, has always gone really well. You can ask me later what course I feel ought to be taught, so I'll leave that one till then. Social and economic, interesting enough, was one that I liked and enjoyed when I was at school, but I didn't like teaching it, and children don't get so motivated by it.
So you mean 19th
yeah.
century, you know,
yeah.
Social economic, because it used
yeah.
to be very popular, and now nobody teaches it for GCSE.
No.
Why do you think that's happened, that change?
It's dry.
But it wasn't obviously at the time when people leapt on it with enthusiasm. About a third of students used to learn social and economic history for GCSE in the 70s and 80s.
Well, when I had to teach it, I don't remember them leaping on it with enthusiasm. I remember them doing it.
Staff must have done that, mustn't they?
No, I don't think so. I think they did it because it was there.
What you mean, the other options were less preferable?
Well, I don't remember definitely, but weren't the basic options social and economic history at GCSE or political history?
Mm.
And I suppose the social and economic did give you the chance to do topics, like I said earlier, which kids really like public health.
Mm.
Whereas if you're doing the political history, you're going from one prime minister after the other, aren't you?
Mm.
So I think social and economic, looking back, is dry and dull in parts, but it was less dry and dull in parts than potentially political history could be.
So, did social history kids like? Is there any? Do they like studying wars and battles?
A little bit gender orientated, this one. Boys like wars, girls not so much. I find these days they like studying, they do like to know about events they've heard about. So when we do a run through the 20th century in year 9, I find they're highly motivated by First World War, Tommy Bomb, Pearl Harbor, all those sort of topics. I haven't had experience of teaching post 45, but I think it's getting very important to do that now, and I'll be interested to see their response to that when it comes.
By contrast, do you think there are some topics like the Battle of Hastings which appeal particularly to younger children? Or do you think that's just tradition that we've always taught that in year 7?
I think year 7s do enjoy the Battle of Hastings. I think they do think it's important that they know about it, but I think they enjoy the topic, and I always enjoy teaching it.
But do you think there's something inherently appealing about that to younger children?
I haven't taught younger children for several years, so I'm not certain now.
I wondered whether you thought there was some conflict between the topics that are appealing and the things that, say, government would like children to learn in history. For instance, the development of parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, that's definitely an issue. But the bigger problem is time. You know, the newspapers are always doing this thing where they go out into the street and ask 20 people 20 key historical facts, which nobody ever knows. But nobody ever answers the question of how you'd find the time on 1 or 2 hours a week, which is what most schools have for history, to cover everything that everybody thinks that everybody ought to know. And it seems to me that the challenge is to try and give the kids an overview of British history, which we do in years 7 to 9, hope to motivate them to be concerned and interested in their history. And there's no doubt that certain things like Nelson and such like, they're going to have to come to probably in later life, because there's not going to be the time to learn them all in the period that the history curriculum has in school. And when it comes down to it, one wonders whether an overview of British history without something like Nelson is probably better than a bit more British history but dropping something like the Holocaust or World War II or World War I.
Brings me on to the national curriculum. Most commentators do think it's had a big effect on history teaching. Would you say it was for the better or worse compared with your experience before that?
I wasn't a curriculum leader when the national curriculum came in, but I do have some views on its impact. Broadly speaking, I think the national curriculum was a positive development, although the overall approach of allowing subject specialists to work in silos on their subjects and then to lump the whole lot together made it much too unwieldy, overcrowded, both within subjects and in totality. In history, the outline British themes through years 7 to 9 made sense for developing a background on our cultural heritage, It was also important, with lots of students finishing history at the end of year nine, that we did the 20th century unit, which I think they needed to have access to. I think the work on assessment was very good, and the arrival of levels was very helpful to teachers in making sure that they wrote assessments which gave particularly the brighter children the chance to reach higher levels of understanding. I always remember that children in the factories during the Industrial Revolution had been a popular topic with children, but before this new assessment regime, the students would tend to write long and highly motivated pieces, but they're all based around how dreadful it was in the factories. After the new national curriculum assessment procedures, we ensured that what they wrote included this, but also other perspectives, such as Robert Owen's factories, or why children actually might have wanted to work in the factories, the point of view of the parents, and also the impact of parliamentary debates. In this way, the students got a much better historical appreciation of children working in the factories, rather than just knowing that their fingers were chopped off in the machines.
So do you think teachers were really moving to a much more careful scrutiny
yes.
of what children
yes,
were doing?
Yes, absolutely. I think, a lot of this sort of came from SHP, but the National Curriculum put it through the whole system for the first time.
And right down to year seven?
Yes.
And below, I
yes.
suppose.
Yeah, and below as well, yeah.
So were there any negatives then?
As I said, I wasn't... Well, I've said it really. There was a little bit too much put in. Mm. And obviously it's been thinned out since. But I really felt the National Curriculum in History was a synthesis of the best elements of history teaching. I wasn't a head of department at the time, so I can't really go any deeper in my comments, but I was positive about it.
So just going through, you moved from Crownwoods to Beacon College.
That's right, yes.
In 82, so you've been there for the rest of your career.
Yes, yes.
So when did you become the head of history?
In 82, I came as head of history.
Right, and then did you move up the scale in terms of promotion?
Yeah, I basically was head of history for about 13 years, I think. During that time, I did the PGCE at Sussex. I also was a senior teacher in the school running alongside being head of history. And then in the late 90s, I think I became a senior teacher without head of history. And then sometimes around 2000, an assistant principal and later deputy principal in charge of the curriculum.
So during that period when you were head of history, the
yeah.
National Curriculum was brought in. Can you remember?
When was the National Curriculum brought in?
1990 to 1991. So
wow. So I was head of history.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
And you've forgotten that.
Yeah, I've forgotten.
Can you remember any of the support you had at Beacon for the delivery of the National Curriculum?
I remember the booklets. And I thought they were quite useful. Yeah.
You didn't go on any sort of training days?
No, I remember very little about it.
How much has history in the sixth form changed during your career?
Right. I think there's been quite big changes in the teaching of history in the sixth form. When I started in the mid-70s, the core elements of an A-level history teaching seemed to me to consist of the following. A teacher with a folder of notes, who in not very imaginative ways would need to transfer the content and ideas to the students. There were quite small history teaching groups, and the children would sit around the room like they did lower down the school.
By quite small, you mean?
Yeah.
Six to eight,
something like that. And we tended to be located in rooms all over the school at the end of the timetable. There was a sense of a constant battle to get through all the content in the time available, and all homeworks were either note-taking or writing essays, which were done at home rather than in time conditions at school. The vitality of the lessons was probably mainly based around how much discussion and debate one was able to engender. Apart from a few small developments based around seeking to motivate the students, and to find new ways to present the material, this was how the courses were taught for many years. Some of the things I did which are a little bit different, I remember inviting sixth formers round to my house to play the game Diplomacy. One or two took on the optional projects which existed at the time, and this was, in my view, highly valuable in preparing them for university.
That was writing their own studying.
Yes. It could also be a good fallback if an exam project, if an exam paper went wrong. For instance, I remember one student getting her Cambridge University place on the basis of her project on Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland because her exam paper had gone wrong. And another student entered her project for a national competition and achieved a prize with a presentation from Prince Edward at the Imperial War Museum. In teaching terms, the increasing access to reprographic facilities and TV film allowed one to produce new resources to vary the way the material was engaged with by the students. But I think the changes in teaching at A-level came much more slowly than in the 11 to 16 age group. This tended to cause difficulties for students moving from GCSE to A-level.
So it's the nature of the exam that dictated the pace of change. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, assessment always leads what you do. So this caused difficulties for students moving from GCSE to A-level because those with strong brain power but not such good literacy could do well at GCSE but found it difficult and became disillusioned when they moved to A-level and found it very difficult to produce the necessary extended essay writing. The first radical change I became aware of was, I think, the Cambridge A-level project. But for reasons I can't remember, we decided not to do it. Our first departure to a new approach was when we started AEB 673, which I believe was underpinned by the thinking of John Fiennes.
Can you remember what year that was?
No. And I've stated my views on this course in another part of the interview. The next stimulus to change was, I think, Curriculum 2000. I think this worked quite well since it built on a synthesis of skills and content and allowed one to build a coherent and interesting course for the students.
Can you remember much about the 673 course? Was that a precursor to the Curriculum 2000 changes?
No, I think it was something totally separate. I think the Cambridge project and the AEB 673 were a sort of SHP type approach to A level. And I don't know why, but there's something about the Cambridge one which meant that we didn't do it. And I'd have to look again at what it proposed to jog my memory on why we didn't do it. But the AEB 673 had a traditional paper of content over time, but then it had this paper on methodology, which I found very interesting to teach, but I think in the end the totality of it didn't have a coherence.
And because it was blending the old and the new.
Well, it was just jumping around lots of different topics, and a lot of them were really interesting in their own right, but in the end they came a little bit of a mismatch. But it did prepare us well for when Curriculum 2000 came along, that we'd had experience of working with sources and historiography and such like, because you could have avoided all that on the traditional papers. So with the new Curriculum 2000, I thought it was a good synthesis of skills and content, and also allowed us to build a coherent and interesting course for the students. But for the first time, we got modular exams and the ability to continually retake modules. And again, with accountability and league tables, I think this impacted on the teaching in ways that I've mentioned elsewhere in the interview. I also feel that by this time, the experience of a sixth form history lesson was much more stimulating for students than when I'd first started. This was for the following reasons. Textbooks were now much more stimulating and gave all teachers innovative ideas on presenting the material. Enhanced technology made more interesting teaching approaches possible and gave greater access to sources and information for staff and students alike. The students' seating pattern had changed in classrooms now and was a sort of horseshoe shape, so that everybody felt that they were involved in the lessons.
Did you do more discussion?
Yeah, definitely, with more children as well. And there were more varied assessment methods, gave more pupils the chances to succeed. So with the Curriculum 2000, the great sweep of history study had been lost, but I've never seen any evidence that the students were any better informed on their historic appreciation from doing the broad sweep than from when they've done a topic approach.
Did you ever have complaints from universities that it didn't prepare them as well for their courses?
Not specifically, no. I've read about them in the papers,
yeah.
Yes.
But what's your view on that? That the university should change, and in fact, perhaps they have done now, but or that it needed to be a more hybrid course that did include more literary skills?
If it's a realistic... You've always got to be careful with universities, because I think one of the big issues that keeps getting forgotten is that 6 to 10% used to go to universities, now 50% go. So inevitably that there are going to be students without the literary capabilities of earlier eras. So it may be that the university courses have to change. But if they're saying that the brightest and best are not equipped to follow a university course, then I do feel, as I mentioned earlier, that possibly at GCSE and A-level, there should be a little bit more broader essay writing, but also retaining some of the developments that they've got so far.
And the coursework side of things, do you think that there has been enough development of coursework, or even too much at A-level?
I think coursework is really, really valuable. The only problem has come now to the race for exam grades, that the pressure on teachers to structure the coursework so tightly so that the students get high grades means that the benefits of it are not as great as they used to be.
Mm.
And I don't know what the answer to that is.
Mm. You referred to the textbooks,
yeah,
initiating new active learning practices in the classroom. Do you think that as a textbook writer, do you think that that has had a big impact, that teachers have picked up a lot of ideas from textbooks?
I hope so. I mean, John and I worked on those A-level books, and we one of our main motives was, we know how hard it is for teachers to write their 20 lessons a week, and we try to build into the textbooks lively, stimulating, imaginative ways of approaching the material, which wouldn't mean that there's 100 teachers sitting at home for 2 hours every night trying to come up with their own individual ideas.
And that was the case before?
I think so, yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But do you think that the process has, that textbooks have included, apart from your own perhaps, that they have included enough exercises and innovative ideas?
Well, I do think ours have got more than most. Others have tried, yes.
Let's move on now to talk about technology, which is something you're enthusiastic about, I know. Has technology had a big impact on your teaching?
Yes, technology has made an impact on my teaching over time. But you're right to push me in what's made the most positive difference to students' learning of history. I mean, first of all, can I deal with technology linked to making significant material available to the students? In the 70s, apart from textbooks, there's little more than the Bandit machine for producing sheets with information or teaching ideas on. And of course, being a useless artist, there's no capacity for visuals either. The amount of content or information which could be covered on a Bandit sheet was minimal. Reel-to-reel film existed in black and white for the odd topic, and the pride and joy of any history department was a carousel projector with slides. In terms of students' learning of history, these stimulated them with new approaches, but did not in themselves enhance the understanding that much. The arrival of the affordable photocopier transformed one's capacity as a teacher to create usable and stimulating teaching materials, which could be structured in a way which allowed you to achieve your teaching objectives. Thus, I produced the teaching materials on a hierarchy of thinking about evidence evaluation, which later became the John Murray textbook, What is Evidence? John Hite, who I work with as a colleague and co-writer, produced a fascinating way into topics such as his ideas on how to get pupils thinking about the implications of the Holocaust. None of this would have been possible without affordable technology. ICT has, of course, been the most revolutionary change, but careful thought needs to be applied when considering how much it has contributed to students' understanding of history. Here are some of my reflections. All teachers have used videos for lessons, sometimes because they cover a topic well, but other times for a breather. I've also thought that showing a long film is not the best way of helping students learn. To me, the best way is to show clips and build them into a larger whole. I've used this approach effectively in teaching about Ireland using extracts from the 1970s ITV films, The Troubles. On another topic, one of my most effective ever lessons is featured in the What is Evidence book, where a 15-second film clip is linked with written sources to generate a situation where the students have the opportunity to decide what actually happened at the suffragette derby in 1912. And most come to the conclusion that the pre-2000 history books got it wrong, which is quite an exciting find for the students. So I used technology in that lesson, but only for 15 seconds. Now, of course, with the internet and YouTube, clips can be built into lessons and can be easily accessed in a very effective manner. The internet has, over the last 5 years, totally radicalised the material staff and students can get hold of. Although I've not taught that much history in recent years, the ability to find exactly what you want to meet the needs of the lesson is extraordinary. Just on a simple level, I taught the Crimean War at A level for the first time last year. I typed into Google the names of the battles and was immediately able to download pictures of local hostelries or pubs for an initial stimulus lesson named after the battles. In a similar way, the capacity to get maps and diagrams to illustrate events is unparalleled. Also, of course, ICT allows you to trawl the net for teaching ideas, resources put up there by others, and you can also run an internal intranet where staff can access each other's teaching. So this is the knowledge economy working in history teaching. Computers and historical games have, in my experience, not been so successful in improving students' learning of history. Over the years, the only one I achieved any mileage out of, in the sense of students enjoying it and getting any learning, was a game about buying stocks and shares in the 19th century, in 1920s America, called Wall Street. I think in many ways the most important challenge for history teachers is to harness technology for improving students' understanding of history. The areas where staff can fall into just using the computer for typing up there are areas where staff can just fall into, such as using computers for typing up work and also for cutting and pasting information without the students processing it. What good history teachers need to do are some of the following. Technology can be useful using cut and paste to organise information, to prepare it in a rational order for answering an essay question. I've used ICT here to prepare students to answer a question at GCSE level on the major factors in bringing Hitler into power. I think virtual learning environments have great potential, particularly at A level. I have myself used Moodle to place a whole course online and built in associated learning activities into it. So on my VLE, students can build a glossary together of keywords which they can all access. They can co-construct pieces of work. They can read and evaluate each other's work. I also built a self-evaluation tool into the Moodle where the students could evaluate the elements which were and were not in their essays. They used to do this after each essay to see if they were managed to eliminate previous weaknesses. There's also a tool where students could email me to ask questions. We had a forum where they could, for example, write paragraph answers and all see each other's offerings. I could also feedback to the students on Moodle, and it also gave me the interesting information of when the students were doing their work. Finally, I was able to post any resources such as exam papers, worksheets on the Moodle, and the students had access to them whenever they need them. In the era of personalisation, I think it's in this sort of area where the ICT has the most interesting possibilities.
Sounds as if you spent a lot of time acquiring the ability to use this technology.
Yes, yes.
Do you think you're untypical of history teachers?
Yes. I was determined to use Moodle, and I put in a lot of time. We need a tool that is not so clunky and is more easily accessible to staff. But then probably when computing started, you had to put in a lot of time to not get very far. And in time, I suspect we'll all become VLE experts.
So it's just a matter of time and turnover of staff?
Time, turnover of staff, and the ability of the technology to do what you want it to do in a sensible time.
What do you think about the impact of the electronic whiteboard?
Well, fantastic, but you've got to look at all the different ways of using it and not make sure that death by a thousand worksheets becomes death by a thousand PowerPoints.
That's a nice phrase. You talked about co-construction.
Yes.
Obviously, the VLE and the computer side of things could enable far more co-construction by students of their own learning.
Yes.
But does that not disempower the tutor, the teacher, from the design of the learning, which obviously you've very much been involved in as your main job, to create the learning environment, the learning resources for your students?
No, I don't. It doesn't disempower the teacher. They set up the parameters, and then there's some leeway for the students within the parameters. But if you're a good teacher, you'll set it up in such a way that the students won't go off in a direction which is of little use to you. That's always the challenge of a teacher. And in my experience, when children are co-constructing, they go bonkers with enthusiasm. You know, I've read 92-page World War I diaries because I allowed them to bury them in the back garden and burn them and put artifacts in with them. So in their fun, they forget that they're doing their written history.
Some publishers have suggested that downloadable pre-planned electronic lessons and opportunities for learning could be the way forward to help teachers, so they've got more time for assessments, say, or for personal coaching.
Yeah.
Do you think that is likely to happen?
Yes, I do. I mean, we all do things in our own ways, but I think if they produce these things, which include things like the clips, film clips that you might use, some assessment guidance and such like, and you had the capacity to slightly adapt it, then it would work great.
So it's the ability to mould it to your students, to your circumstances.
Exactly, to the length of your lessons, to the way that you block your students. You know, have you got sets or mixed ability? You have to localise anything like this.
Recent trends in school curriculum seem to be squeezing the time available for history. It's something you've already mentioned.
Mm.
Is that something that you've experienced at your own school, and is it related to the status of history?
Right, history is a popular and successful subject in my school, but I do have some underlying concerns. It's popular because the department is well qualified, bright, hardworking, stable and innovative. Students know they get a good deal with the history teachers. It's the most popular option at GCSE, 5 classes from a 10 form entry. However, such is the hold of exam league tables that the pressure is now on to not let students who would get below a C to do it. Unless the league table madness diminishes soon, I can see a whole category of child being disenfranchised from history after year 9.
So that's probably 50% of children.
Yep. At A level, history does well too, but it's not as popular as psychology, sociology and media. I think the literary demands, its more traditional demeanour and the lack of the sexiness of history associated with the other subjects I mentioned is the reason for reducing the uptake. Having said that, I still feel the students and parents see history as a high status A level. At Key Stage 3, the latest developments may see two things happening. There may be some move back to integrated humanities, and with student pathways moving into year 9, there are now some students who may give up history in year 8. I've got a couple of thoughts on this. I think integration can work if you've got a well-led, committed team with stable staff, given meeting time and clear assessment objectives laid out for all pieces of work. Unfortunately, I've never seen these circumstances ever hold true inside a school.
Have you actually taught integration?
Yes, I have. And we have a version of it running at our school now, which we call, which is a modular humanities. So in other words, we have one teacher, so that allows you to have four lessons a week with the, but we teach blocks of geography, history and RS. And they're written by each of the departments, but delivered by whoever the teacher is in front. And I think that works quite well. Now, year nine's giving up history. This is a really difficult one. We are moving away from a broad and balanced curriculum to giving students what will motivate them. Although I've been party to this, I'm concerned that if this goes on, we're going to make it that every bricklayer's son becomes a bricklayer, and that perhaps we do not broaden the opportunity of some children.
What do you think is the origin of this feeling we've got to, if you like, suit the individual and start with what the child knows, that sort of thing? The implication here is that because they only know the world of bricklaying, yeah, they're going to choose to be bricklayers.
It seems to be linked to their motivation to do anything. I mean, I was a strong believer in broad and balanced curriculum up to 16. But then when lifelong learning came along, I mean, in the past, if you got to 16 and you failed at school, that was it. In the early 90s, I taught on an access course for 3 or 4 years, and I met a load of people aged 21 to 72, all of whom had failed at school for different reasons. All of them now could succeed. But the reasons they failed were family breakup, literacy issues, emotional problems. They got all over those now and they were ready to learn. And they did this access course and they got on and most of them got a university degree. So once I'd experienced that and I began to see the pressure to get away from broad and balanced, I moved over to the thing that if we could find something that students could study in 9, 10 and 11, like motor mechanics or bricklaying or agriculture, and they wanted to do it and they saw it as relevant and they got some qualifications in it, then maybe it was better that they didn't sit at the back of a French lesson or a history lesson and do nothing and be disruptive, and that maybe I wasn't disenfranchising them because maybe later on they might come back to this. So if lifelong learning is a true reality, and some of the children we get coming into schools now with such low-level aspiration and such low-level motivation, that maybe this adapted curriculum can be tried, but I do worry about it.
That it's simply pigeonholing students,
yes,
according to their social economic,
yes,
background.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's finish on something cheerful. If you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be and to what age group?
Now, you may be surprised by my answer here because this topic gets so much bad publicity. But it would be Weimar and Nazi Germany, 1919-45, but without dwelling on the war, and it would be to GCSE students. The reason I would choose this is that this topic has so many fascinating incidents and stories that it keeps the students really interested. And the topics also allow you to address the major political, social, economic, religious issues on which they need to develop their own perspective. It also includes racial issues and the Holocaust, and these can be reflected on in a historical setting. It also allows the students to reflect on the causes and the results of war. I think when they've done this topic, they're well placed to use the learning to better understand their world today and to develop their own issue, sort of develop their own ideas on key issues. And if I may just give a couple of specific examples, when you start teaching Weimar, you start talking about voting systems. And that is just so relevant to Britain today that, you know, I go into all the PR and all that sort of stuff. When you do 1923-29, you're talking about inflation, recession, depression. It's so relevant to Britain today. So rather, and trendily, that will be my topic, and those will be the students I would teach.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Okay.